Good afternoon. We are going to start our deliberations this afternoon on weight regulated activities. Yeah.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon, everybody. We're here to discuss papers 9 through 9D. And just to start, I just wanted to highlight in paragraph 6 of paper 9, the cover note, it mentions two different types of rate regulation, one of which is market regulation, which we suggest acts as a substitute for competition to try to restrict prices. The other type is what we've been calling defined rate regulation through the project, which does go beyond market regulation. And our discussions this afternoon are focusing on that second type of rate regulation. The appendix of paper 9 does provide you with an overview of the model that we presented in the education session in December. We've refined that appendix to reflect the contents of the papers today. And today we're going to be focusing on the general approach of the model, its scope and some criteria for recognition of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. Other aspects such as measurement, presentation, etc. we'll come back to at a later time. Turning, if I can, to agenda paper 9A. In this paper, we describe how the relationships between the regulated entity, the rate regulator, and the regulated entity's customers interact. And again, we've talked about that in the past. In particular, in paragraph 16, we highlight that the rate regulator looks at the entity's customers as a single body, as a collective of customers, which we term the customer base. And so we'll use the term customer base throughout to identify this single body of customers. We also note in paper 9A that the rate regulator establishes what goods and services the entity is obliged to transfer or deliver to the customer base. And also, the rate regulator then establishes a payment schedule which identifies what compensation the entity is entitled to in exchange for delivering those goods and services. And as highlighted in paragraph 10 of paper 9A, the rate regulator then establishes the regulatory agreement, which we see as being a form of contract for the entity to exchange resources with the customer base, which means the entity has got an obligation to transfer goods and services to the customer base and in exchange has a right to receive compensation for that delivery. We think that this exchange contract is similar in nature to the types of contracts addressed in IFRS 15 on revenue from contracts with customers. So in this case, the terms and conditions of the contract, the contracts between the entity and its individual customers, we think are designed to then facilitate the terms and conditions of the regulatory agreement. In this way, we think the regulatory agreements and the contracts with the individual customers supplement each other, and therefore we propose a general approach for the model to be a supplementary type of approach, which means that we are highlighting through the regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities the additional rights and obligations created through the regulatory agreement over and above those rights and obligations that are addressed in those individual contracts with customers. So, before asking whether you agree with that analysis and general approach, I'll open up to ask if you've got any questions or comments on paper 9.
You know, I want to act as an opponent to this project, but this time we're not emotional because we start having a discussion. I have to challenge this through technical ground. This paper has three problems. Firstly, you start with the extended contract notion, and give me impression, you interchangeably use agreement with regulators and a contract between the supply and the customer. And that's a really the core ideas of this proposal is, you know, the regulatory decision or any kind of agreement will tie up the relationship between the customer and the supplier. But I personally feel, you know, there are differences, you know. In reality, the company, you know, send the checks to the other side, and the other side pay to the supplier of any service is between them. And use the term agreement between the regulator and the entity, and entity with the customer interchangeably. In particular, for example, the inception of the agreement, I would feel it's different from the inception of contractual relationship with the customer. And in many cases, regulatory agreements and the regulatory decision on future chewing, you know, or adjustment will not be exactly the same as in our standards at inception of the contractual relationship. Now, this is my first point. My second point is, you know, to use exactly a notion, actually the main purpose is to justify, you know, we are all still okay to recognize, in my, you know, term, deferred debit or credit, you know. I can see the reason why staff are doing so is because we fail to give strong basis from asset liability perspective. But I don't feel through this way we can escape such a conceptual decision. That is, any debit, credit, you know, any name, you know, adjustment or asset liability or deferred debit or credit must be justified whether, you know, we feel it is okay, you know. I personally feel I will not accept. A change of the way, the direction to justify, I personally cannot solve the issue still there. So when I commented to the original DP and we discussed the original DP, I clearly said, you know, the issue still, you know, whether we accept such a debit credit rather than, you know, through such a long circle. I don't think the issue is gone.
Comment, one of which picks up on a point of Wei Guo's, without, unlike his being offered as disagreement with the paper. I think one of the things that comes through to me from our past discussions is that we're going to have to be very disciplined and consistent in the vocabulary we use to make, to signal distinctions. And I think we have to talk about customer base and regulatory agreement together and make sure that people are aware when we use the phrase customer base, we're talking about things that are recovered through billings to individual customers, but it's that this idea of customer base is kind of the other face of the regulatory agreement. And I think, you know, not for now, but to me it's very important that this notion of customer base is something that really is sustained only by the regulatory agreement, rather than it's a pervasive notion in IFRS, and it's just a kind of a specialist view of portfolio of customers, or the kind of thing we talked about in, you know, in the leasing standard. This to me is unique to regulatory environment and a subset of the regulatory environment. And if after we consult, we decide to go ahead with it, it isn't a new way of thinking about IFRS, but it's something that's created in this circumstance in particular.
But if I may interject, Mary, do we need the term customer base?
I think,
don't we just talk about customers?
I think we do, because I think that's part of what the staff is looking at here is saying, if I'm the utility, I have a relationship with my customers,
yeah,
to whom I deliver electricity. And I generate, let's say, and I generate revenue, P times Q, the price that's been agreed and the quantity I deliver to you. But additionally, Gary is my rate is my regulator. And in addition to having a direct hand on what the P is in the, you know, my dealings with you, he also is laying operational requirements on me in terms of, you know, how the service capacity, the quality, etc. You know, it varies industry to industry depending upon what it is, and I have to do certain things in response to the requirements he imposes on me. And what he says is, he's going to impose these on me. In return, he's going to keep competitors out so that I can have a degree of assurance about recovery. And he's going to make you guys pay for it, but he's not going to make you guys pay for it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's the customer.
I still don't see why we need to turn up a customer base.
Hans is focusing on the difference between just saying customers, plural, and customer base. And I think what you're trying to get at, Joan, if I understand correctly, is even though the population of those customers may change because individuals will come in and out, we're talking about that customer base as a collective concept, which may be not today's customers. It could be new ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what you're trying to get to, yeah?
But I think that customer base notion is what gets over Wigwo's, I think it was the second point about whether or not the asset or liability that would be recognized is consistent with the conceptual framework. Because today I can't make a claim on you for electricity I haven't delivered. But this customer base notion is distinct from individual customer relationships. Yes, it supports the probability, but this ain't about probability. It's about a right, which is why we get back to the definition of asset. So personally, I think we need it, but I think we need to be very careful and cautious in our use of it. And I'm not sure we're quite there yet in some of the descriptions, and I'm looking in particular at paragraph, I think it's 29. And, because I think this commingles the compensation I'll receive for delivering the electricity to Hans in the current period with the performance obligations that Gary has imposed on me. So I think it's in the right direction and it's capturing the sense of what we're trying for, but it brings in both the individual customer relationship as well as customer based notion, so I think it has to be kind of in excess of the revenue that I'm entitled to for the delivery of goods and services to customers. You know, and that's not precise drafting, but
I think you're right, Mary, in terms of we are trying to capture this wider concept of a changing population of customers, and the way that the regulation works is to look at that wider collective, and that's how the regulator can operate and make sure that there is a continuity of the service and also a continuity of payments to the payments to the entity that is equitable for the different customers as well as being, you know, financially viable for the company itself, the entity itself. But, yeah.
Stephen?
So as you know, I'm supportive of the debits and credits, but I struggle with the concepts that is there. So again, this paragraph and this the confusion of you've got individual customers and you have a contract with them and you sign with their electricity and they pay you, and then the customer base as a whole and their compensation. I find that confusing. So this principle, I struggle to sort of take the storm damage and the future customer base is paying for the storm damage example. I struggle to fit that into the principle because of this confusion, I think, between the customers and the customer base. To my mind, what we're trying to do is very simple, that the regulator is imposing something on the future customer base on top of market regulation. So the regulator says, on a market regulation basis, you'll pay 100, but sorry guys, you're going to have to pay 110 for 5 years because we need to get some more money to rectify the storm damage. Or, you know, we've overcharged you in the past, we're really sorry about it, so we're going to charge you 95 in the future. And that's essentially all it is. Yeah. It's forcing the future customer base to pay more, pay less than they would have done otherwise. And I find the core principle makes it sound more complicated than perhaps it really needs to be. But I haven't got an alternative for you, and I recognize that it's difficult to explain.
I think your summary, though, is what we're trying to get at here is absolutely right. It is that payment schedule, the regulator is determining when payments come through, which don't always tie in exactly with what's being delivered at any one time.
Well, that's the thing, you see. All I'm doing is delivering electricity. There's nothing else. And it's, we're using the customer base to achieve something else, which in this case is giving the company enough money to deal with the storm damage.
Jane, do you think that the storm damage is also transferring a regulated good or service?
I think the storm damage is one that we're going to have a specific discussion about, because I hear people arguing both ways.
Can I put it another way? Do you think the transfer of rate-regulated goods and services is the delivery of something bigger than just on selling you units of electricity?
I think there is something wider than that, which is it's not just the number of units of electricity that's being transferred, it's the fact that it's available on tap. So there is also paying for, I think, this convenience of always having that continuity of supply. And it applies to, you know, various different scenarios. So I think there is a slightly bigger element than just the physical transfer of things.
I think there are these additional qualities that the regulator imposes on the goods and services that are being transferred that basically creates these obligations that we're trying to capture through this model.
Martin.
I'm also still struggling with this customer base, and because if I compare it to a non-regulated company, which has also a customer base, which maybe also has a storm damage or a fire, whatever, which has to repair their property plan equipment or whatever, and also then, okay, increases the price, not immediately, but maybe over the next 5 years, because the market determines that they cannot increase the price because they have competitors, and so the future customer base is also paying for maybe the current damage of that. And from that perspective, I'm struggling, why is that so different? Only because it is a regulator, maybe the market is also a regulator to determine prices, why we accepting that some costs or whatever currently happens and maybe are charged to future customers, we can account for that if it is the future price are regulated by a regulator and not by the market or any other. And why is that so different, and why do you think, okay, it is conceptually so different that we have to reflect? That is what I'm struggling with. Because customer base has everything. And I assume that in your defined
rate regulation?
That, okay, maybe the customer base is more stable. But I compare it to Apple. I think also Apple has a very stable customer base. Or other companies which are big brand, good brand, have also very stable customer base, where I think it's also possible, there's a high probability you can forecast really, okay, the stability of this customer base. So it is not unique, I think, to this. And I said, well, but that is my main problem, is okay, that I think a lot of situations where people or companies reflecting some costs, which has to be then, I think, compensated for by price increases for the future customer base. Why is that so different? That is my main struggle with this.
I actually don't struggle at all with the difference between a customer and a customer base. And you step back and say the customer base is kind of like a macro concept. We negotiate the regional rates, the regional expectation, and so on. And I think since the industry uses that phrase so much, I'd be loath to move from it, because I think it's widely understood by the people that need to understand these things, as opposed to the customers is kind of like the macro level. That's who gets the bill. You know, the power line breaks, you call. That's a customer level transaction, sort of a micro issue. So I think there are different things. I mean, the Venn diagrams overlap to a great degree. But one is really for rate setting, one is for just daily billing and day-to-day servicing. Now, in some ways, I just think a little bit outside of the box on all of this. And some, if you talk about the regulator or the legal, you know, this legal positioning and stuff, some ways we step back, think of the regulator as like binding arbitration. You move into an area and you take everything that's in the air, including there's going to be a public utility and there's going to be a rate regulator. The rate regulator negotiates your rates on your behalf. Likewise, if you're a public utility in your operating area, you know you're going to operate with a regulator, with a pricing regulator in there. We'll also set the standards. In some ways, it's like binding arbitration. You know, if you go into the area, you go into it, the regulator is there, whether the using customer or the service delivery entity, and you negotiate, but basically it's kind of like binding arbitration. They tell you at the end, this is the rates, this is the price.
And first of all, I would like to say that I support the model that is would go on by saying that one of the elements that I think is very important to me in the support of that model is that indeed the model takes into account the transfer of goods and services to the end customer and not anything else. So to me, that's a very important strength in that model. The fact that some other elements play a role, let it be quality, let it be availability, let it be repair of a storm damage, all these to me originate in the fact that whatever the rate regulation, it has some form of cost basis, cost computation in order to arrive at the rate regulated price. So in fact, the price that the customer pays in exchange for the goods received is the final price as far as this individual customer is concerned, but it is the tentative price in regard of the rate regulation. So that in fact the rate regulation is a form of mutualization scheme among various customers. One is going to pay less than he would have had to pay if the final price had been available, and it's the next customer that will pay more or less, I mean, depending on how it works, when the next delivery takes place. And I think that's, that should respond to Mary's concern that the customer base plays a role indeed very specific to the rate regulation, because it's the rate regulation creating that mutualization scheme that brings the customers together. So that has nothing to do, is very dissimilar from the customer base of Apple. Because there is no mutualization mechanism among various customers that provide Apple 7, Apple 8, and the like. So I wanted to make those points because to me, the key in getting the model right.
Very helpful, thank you.
Thanks, Hans. This is my reaction to the paper. I think, actually, you did a great job bringing to the table an important aspect of the whole discussion. Just to remind us, we are discussing this for quite a number of years now, since we decided to publish IFRS, to issue IFRS 14. And we didn't use here the expression that we used before, maybe at inception, a tripartite aspect. Maybe if we had brought back, at least that as an introduction, the tripartite, recalling us pointing out what is the origin of all this discussion. The origin basically is that I perform I provide goods and services as a result of a regulatory agreement. This is the first point. And, of course, to a customer base. So, my reading of paragraph 29, that is the core of the discussion, because it's the core principles of the model, is that you are bringing as a first step or first try the notion of the customer base and the performance between the company, from the company to the customer base as an introduction to facilitate discussion. And I understood that you were trying basically to incorporate what's the notion of IFRS 15 and substituting, let's say, the wording in paragraph in IFRS 15 to what we've learned during this journey in this year. I guess what is really what can be enhanced here is, as the result of all the discussion, that actually we are firstly trying to depict the rights and obligations that arise as the result of the direct regulatory agreement between the company and the regulator. Because this, as Gary rightly said, this is binding. So I am providing because I have the agreement. So, and as in aligned with Gary, I don't struggle with the notion. We might not have the right wording. We might not have it perfectly established as a principle, but I think we are in the right direction. If we are aiming to explore this tripartite and the results and rights and obligations of this tripartite relationship.
So,
if I had to choose who I'm closest to in terms of the comments that have been made so far, I think it's probably closest to Steve. I used to be where Martin was because I kept talking about Apple, I think. Not at the board table, certainly one-on-one with you, Jane, but you've worn me down to the point where I believe now that there is a difference because of the regulation for the sorts of reasons that Francoise was mentioning. So I think it is different. So I certainly agree with where you're heading in terms of the debits and credits. I'm also sort of attracted to the concept of trying to build on the sorts of ideas in IFRS 15, but I think where I'm still struggling a little bit, like Steve, is with the, I think what I'm struggling with is trying to work out what the performance obligation is that we're sort of thinking about, and that's why I keep saying to you, but don't you mean storm damage? Because to me that sort of helps me think about it, but I'm not sure you're there yet. But I guess one question is how much can we sort of piggyback off the fact that you've already got the delivery of the IFRS 15 performance obligations, and then that's just true-ups associated with that, so you're not looking for sort of extra performance obligations, which I think is a little bit what Francoise was saying, if I understood it correctly, because I find it much less difficult to think about the extra debits and credits in situations where it's things like cost recovery, because then it really is, it feels more natural as a true-up to the sales that already occurred. It gets tougher when I start to think about things like storm recovery, because I feel like I'm charging for an extra thing, and you don't want that, or you haven't been able to call in that a performance obligation. So I think also for me it's articulation. But I do wonder whether the performance obligation notion is as, I haven't thought this through, but just as a thing. In 15, the performance obligation notion is so central because it's all about the timing of when you're allowed to book things. Here, if it's much more driven by the certainty of the regulation, maybe that delivery concept isn't so fundamental.
Yeah. I mean, my initial, and I feel the storm damage, I mean, if I let you know where I am, I think you're absolutely right. The areas where it is the true up, where it relates to, I think that's easier to see that we've had the transfer and it's a pricing true-up. I think, and we'll get onto it in paper 9C, where we're talking about construction activities. I think that's quite clear. We're not actually transferring anything to the customer, so I think that it is the opposite side. And we are going to get some of these things in the middle, and the storm damage repair, I think, is the tension point between those two sides of it. I have leaning towards it's not a transfer, it is more like a construction type of thing, but it does have characteristics of the true-up type of arrangement. So I think once we can get people comfortable with a basis to work from, that then we can start adding in these the bits that have got characteristics.
In essence, it's the present value of future adjustments of revenue as decided by the regulator.
It's not all the future answers.
Revenue adjustments. Future revenue adjustments.
So it makes it sound really easy when you put it that way.
That's the essence of what it is. And the customer base is not involved at all. In the period that the liability or the asset is being built up, the customer is not even using the services being rendered. Ultimately, they will have to pay, but not in the period that the liability or the asset is being created, or when they have paid too much when the liability is being created. But it's all the whole asset or liability comes into being because of the relationship between the regulator and the company, and nothing else. Customer base has nothing to do with it.
Can I help you?
Yes.
Firstly, I should emphasize customer base is important. I may not agree, because the whole rate setting is based on customer base, frankly. Altruism also based on customer base. So from that point of view, it is important that we cannot escape. But on the other hand, whether our principles can easily set on this basis, the problem. Firstly, as I mentioned, you know, when you account for the individual billing, it's not based on customer basis. It's on you send to Philip, send to me. You know, you cannot send to a customer base, say that, you know, XYZ pay me how much. Firstly. Secondly, you know, I fully agree with Steve's observation. And this is from beginning, I feel it is wrong. That is, you know, the key is, Hans, you're right. How to account for the price movements and some related to other transactions. And for example, the building a plant or, you know, repair the dam. But you have to, you know, the regulator allow you to compensate some way. And you have to, you know, view through rate or, you know, adjust to debit credit, deferred. So, but on the other hand, you know, I would feel the student's right, you know, we cannot purely use revenue standards wording as a principle to look like, you know, use this principle, you know, we can solve all the problems. I don't think so. And maybe 80% of transactions to this company can use this principle. It's okay. Because all related to the performance, you know. But other transactions, you cannot use this notion to the principles to account for. And, we set a series of separate principles. I don't think it is work. And this is why, you know, when we develop these ideas, when we develop EP, a personal review, we go a wrong direction.
Jambu.
Thank you. For Amaro. I have a question on the Martin. Martin raised a very interesting observation. Here, the capital markets, unregulated markets, they are doing the same. And regulated markets are doing the same. So my question is, do you think this kind of a regulatory adjustment cannot be recognized as an asset or
not? That is my concern, because I don't see why is it so different. Because as I said, because other companies have also this kind of damages, which they don't immediately charge to their current customer, but maybe they have price increases and charge it to future customers. And why you can do it only if, okay, the regulators, then you can determine, you can increase the price. The company which is not regulated can always increase it. But maybe it's regulated by the market, by competitors, by, I don't know. Why is that so different? That's my question. Why is that so different? Why we then allow in accounting to recognize an asset liabilities for others not, because the economic phenomena is for me not so different. Because it is a kind of future customer base makes...
Because that normal company operating in a competitive environment does not get a guarantee that it can make up for it in the next 5 years. It might just go bust because they were unlucky.
Hans, you know, and when people come at
that is the kind of how probable that is that you have this future customer base, and maybe it is of higher probability with if you are in this kind of defined regulated monopoly situation. But I compare it to Apple. I think also if Apple is increasing the price to maybe 1,000 for an iPhone, also the customer base will be stable and people will pay for that.
I don't think
with so. a high probability. And why is that so different? And that is my question. Why do we think okay?
I think that there's a combination of different features. I think Francois has articulated very well the mutualization idea. There's also the aspect.
Shall we not start this discussion?
The other aspects, though, are also the competition. You know, there is a blockage of competition. So with Apple, yes, it's got a very strong market position, but it is still a market that's open to new entrants and competition coming in. Additionally, I think with this type of rate regulation that we're talking about, as well as the barriers to the competition, there are also obligations imposed on the entity, which does involve making sure that the type of product or the type of service meets certain specifications where, you know, if a competitive company suffers some additional costs, they can modify the product that they're selling, the goods or services, to try and cut costs, to perhaps only provide to certain aspects of the market. These options are not open to an entity with this type of regulation. So this is why it ties together the rights and the obligations. There's a trade-off between the two that I don't think exists in a competitive
market. May I ask the following question? For example, one utility company got a damage from the storm, or now they have a dramatic increase in fuel expenditure. So if we just apply I+15 or I+other, then we have to recognize all huge number of expenses and finally bottom line is a big loss. However, in this case, the regulator guarantees such kind of big expenditures will be recovered in the next 5 years.
But for me, it's a normal course of business. When a lot of companies have explosion of costs and they reflect it in higher prices in the future, and that is normal business. If something happens, if the fire is at a big plan of a company, then okay, what is the company doing? Is they increasing the price for the future? If a bank suffers huge impairment losses, they increase the credit spread for the future loans. And that is, why is that so different? Because when I understand, maybe because it is more guaranteed.
Because they don't have a regulator that tells them normally, your customers cannot walk away because you have a monopoly on this market, and we guarantee you, yes, you have had these horrible losses, but we guarantee you a net interest margin of 3% for the next 5 years.
But I don't think that is okay. Other business is not so totally different. And clearly, if they would increase the price dramatically, they have competitors, they work with a competitor. But they do it in a sensible manner. And maybe they do it over 10 years, not immediately. And that is the same mechanism, because it can, you are determined by a regulator who say, okay, we have to balance that, but otherwise the market, your competitors are balancing how much you can increase your price immediately and if you defer it over a longer period.
But in this case, what utility company has no option to increase the price as they wish. Now, they cannot recover all this huge amount of losses at the current period. That's the big difference between the regulated industry or unregulated industry.
I think the other side to think about as well is obviously if the regulated company makes a profit, then they're not entitled to keep that if it's above the profit that the regulator is considering is reasonable, which I think is quite a big distinction between a competitive, you know, somebody like Apple can make whatever profit they like as long as customers are willing to pay the prices.
We have, sorry to interrupt you, but the difference, Martin, to me, notwithstanding the final results could be quite similar. The difference is that if we think also there's liability can occur, that makes everything distinct. Because the liability will, if you overprice, you have a better return, so you have a liability eventually.
The banking industry is a very interesting example because it's the only industry right now where the labor regulators are trying to even further increase profits when the business is already in bad shape. Daryl?
I'm not entirely sure there's much left to say. I think broadly I'm supportive with where you're going with this. I accept that there's some reservations. To the point that everybody's been discussing now, I don't think there is a difference in principle, if you like, between an Apple customer base and a customer base in a regulated environment. I think the difference is one of degree. And I think the question we're saying here is I would accept that even Apple probably has an asset, well, I know it has an asset because I'm one of its assets, in terms of future customer base that is likely to keep buying. But the difference here is the regulator adds that extra element. And I think the whole crux of this project is when we think that extra element is sufficient that we can provide useful information to users by providing information about that extra element. And for that reason, I'd be comfortable with where we're going.
Doc?
I support almost everything what the staff proposed. I think it's a good model. And this week we discussed two things. One is insurance. The other is price. And in the insurance, as Franz was articulated, we discussed mutualization. And the essence of this rate regulated activity is mutualization. And however, in the insurance contract, we have a different model. And we have a CSM, which is similar to what Hans said. It's just an adjustment of margin. So we could do this way, but we didn't do that because it's related to revenue. And the other thing we discussed is in the FICE. In the FICE discussion, we discussed the impact or influence of law to the contract. So the contract in itself is simple. However, it's under the certain circumstances with the regulations and laws. So the contract with the customer and the electricity companies is simple. However, it's under the regulation. So how much we should take into that does effect into the contract? That is what we discussed in the FICE. So thinking about all these things, maybe the way we could develop is to use IFRS 15 type rather than insurance type. So if we were to use IFRS 15 type, the one thing we have to break through is what is the customer. So in order to break through what is the customer, then the idea of customer base is somehow, you know, compromised, which idea is, as Hans pointed out, is not very clear. But because we decided and the people support us to use IFRS 15, then we cannot help using the concept like a customer base, which is completely different from the ordinary term of customer base, which Martin articulated. So therefore, we define what the customer base is all about in this project, in this regulation, and we use it as a compromise to use IFRS 15. And then we would like to achieve some kind of adjustment of margin, not the way of insurance D, but the way of IFRS 15, another unique model. But I think the point of Sue pointed out, you know, the delivery point is not very clear. I think that is one of the challenges we need to clarify in the future discussion. But all in all, I think the what staff came up with is really good, and it's going to be a breakthrough, and it is worth testing with constituents as a discussion paper.
Gary?
It should have said earlier, but I thought this was a very good set of staff papers, and I'm fully on board with where you're going with the model. I think if you step back, you know, the finer points of customer base and brand loyalty and stuff, I think the whole thing revolves around having stability in a market. I mean, the public utility cannot charge whatever it might. It might, if left to its own devices, you can couch the market, you could do anything you want if you're unconstrained. So for purpose of putting pricing and discipline into it, which might be lower than they'd actually prefer, you might be forced into a capital base or a cost structure, which not be your first choice, but stability comes with that. At the same time, when something bad happens, the storm damage, this whole thing is designed to keep stability, and the stability translates itself and is reasonably stable of pricing to the using customers so they can't. I do think, and I think it's the next paper, or maybe another paper, is I do think the near monopolistic fact is a greater factor in this than perhaps, you know, we're leading. I know the rate regulating agreement, I know, is the linchpin of it. But I think even if you had a regulatory agreement, if you had several choices in the world, it would lose a lot of its efficacy. So banking is regulated, taxi service is regulated, but you can walk up and down the high street, there's 12 different banks. You got Uber, you got black cabs, there's choices in many regulated industries. There is not here. You might have a choice to use it a little less, turn lights out, you know, more frequently, but ultimately you really don't have a choice as a supplier. So it revolves around stability. And I think the model you're working up, tying it to IFRS 13 is best as, or 15, I should say. It is close, as far as that will go, I think is the right way to do it.
Paper 9B is the scope issue, yeah.
Mary?
I'm going to take a lesson from the insurance staff in terms of encouraging us all not to use the term mutualization, because they taught us yesterday that that's a word invoked by many people with different meanings and when they invoke it. But I, you know, the joking aside, I think the notions that come up under that category are useful in terms of benchmarks. I think I've taken from this discussion is that we have to be able to answer Martin's question. Why, if the mechanism is the same, adjusting future billings, why is this scenario different? You know, that's the challenge that's put to me. And I don't agree with Hans's answer that it's because the regulator guarantees something to the entity. The reason I don't agree with that is the regulator is very careful not to put itself on the line and guarantee. The regulator is imposing obligations and helping to provide increased certainty about recovery by control of entry to the market, but the regulator is explicitly not guaranteeing recovery. So I don't think it's that guarantee. Having said that, I think we are on the right track. I think the answer may be more in something that Tuck was referring to, and that is that when he looked back at the discussion that we had in FICE and whether or not law and regulation is incorporated into the classification of the instrument, because the point that came out of that FICE discussion was typically we do not account, we regard law and regulation as executory contracts, and we don't account for them. And I think you're coming at it a different way, but fundamentally you're arguing that in this case of defined rate regulation, we should change our approach for this set of law and regulation and account for the rights and obligations that come from it on an accrual basis rather than on a cash basis. So the same way that we have an exception for income tax, where we have a standard that says it's sufficiently significant that we have to account for it on an accrual basis rather than just when tax becomes due and you have to record the payments, I think we're looking at the rights and obligations that are created here. Now, in terms of do we need customer base or not, I think we may need it more than the model needs it to work. And what I mean by that is I think what you have captured and described as the customer base is the linkage to the conceptual framework's asset definition that requires control. And since the regulator has not guaranteed the recovery, you know, this is to Martin's question, what differentiates this situation from the ability of a well-established company with an intangible that is customer based, whether or not there's an intangible recognized for it. I think the thing that you have labeled customer base is the techies analysis that links it back to the definition of asset and the requirement for control and similarly the obligation, because that is the mechanism. So let's think about how we use the term and whether we phrase it, but that's where I think customer base comes in. But ultimately, I take away from this discussion that our challenge is to say, if the mechanism adjusting future prices is the same as any company in a competitive market, what makes this different? We have to describe what makes that different. And I think I would describe what we're trying to do is define an area in which we unusually account for the rights and obligations from law and regulation on an accrual basis rather than a cash basis.
And I would hope, I mean, I suppose guarantees don't exist, or not in this world, but if the regulatory obligation is not at least contractual and it is not near certain, I think, you know, what you say here, expects to be entitled, I think they should be entitled. Through the regulatory agreements.
We talk about that a little bit in.
So there should be near certainty. If there is not near certainty, we shouldn't go here.
Right, but
then the distance between these companies and Apple is too little.
Just to go back to Mary's, just one additional point. It's generally as a result of a contract between the provider and the regulator. It's not only the application of laws or regulations. Generally, there is a contract in place.
It must be.
Yes. As far as I know, in all situations, there is a contract.
Contract, but not a guarantee.
The guarantee is another aspect. There are schemes that guarantee. The majority don't, but just another aspect. But there is a contract. It's not only law and regulation.
But this principle is not clear to me. It needs to be clear, principle.
Yeah, in the 29.
I cannot make it up on the fly.
Yeah.
But the essence is you have performed an obligation to the regulator, which is a contractual obligation, and you are entitled to receive revenue for that, and then or to have less revenue. Overcharged, and only then the customers come into. But I don't think in the definition you have to use the term customer base. Stephen,
just to react to your phrase near certainty, so I think we've got to be careful as to what hurdles we put on this. There are different types of uncertainty in this. There is the uncertainty about whether the thing that's happened is subject to rate regulation. Because often there's a sort of negotiation there has to be a rate determination at some point. And because of the complexity and the different types of transactions, it's not necessarily certain that it will be covered by the regulation. And then there is the demand uncertainty. So will the customers buy enough of the goods to do the compensation? And there may be uncertainty inherent in the regulation itself. So the regulator might say, we'll give you this amount of money and we'll uplift it by inflation. Well, the inflation's uncertain, and therefore the amount you're going to get is uncertain. Or it'll be uplifted by inflation subject to a limit of 5%. So if inflation is higher, then you don't get fully compensated. So there's all sorts of uncertainties that might be present. And if we start talking about uncertainty, then we get into the question of asymmetry. So are we going to have a different level of certainty required to recognize a liability as opposed to an asset? And the more we get into uncertainty or restrict the regulatory assets and liabilities, the more the investors are going to complain. Because if you have some artificial point where if it's this certain, you recognize it, and if it's more than that uncertain, you don't, you get this cliff effect, and that's going to then confuse the investors. The investors like regulated adjustments because it gives them performance measures that they think better reflect the performance in the period. And if we start constraining it with an uncertainty notion, then I'd be worried that the investors might react negatively to that.
Yeah, can I just follow up on Steve and Hans's point? Because to remind you what we say in uncertainty in the framework, because I think there are different places the uncertainty comes in. So I think the most basic point here is, does the entity have the right to include something in the future billings? And so if you've got that right, there's no doubt there's an asset. There may be some uncertainty about how much you'll actually recover because of demand uncertainty and so on, but you've got the right to include it in the billings. Then there might also be uncertainty about whether, as Steve says, whether it's even sort of within the scope of the regulation. There might be negotiation about that, and that would be existence uncertainty. And what was said in the framework is that's something the board would decide at the standards level how to deal with existence uncertainty. And I think it's important to separate that distinction between the right, which is the right to bill, to include something in future billings, and the ultimate outcome of that, which will depend on other factors such as the level of demand.
I think that the point that makes these regulatory assets and liabilities different from what would happen with customers and entities that would be in the free sector is the fact that, as Hans has summarized it, it's all about revenue adjustments, and it's adjustment to past revenue. So the difference is that you have invoiced your customer on the basis of a price that, from the entity's perspective, because of the rate regulation, is a tentative price. So if you don't book the adjustment, you don't fully reflect your revenue. And the thing that I like in that model is the supplementary approach, because you see the two effects, the one with the contract with the customer, in a way from the customer perspective, and then the supplement brings it from the entity perspective, because its price is a tentative price, but this is past sales. And then you look at what happened, and you can see whether you have a mean of recovery. And the means of recovery, future sales, do play a role only in providing the basis for recovery of something that is born in the period. You have earned your right to supplementary revenue if your tentative price was under what you're entitled to. So it's the future sales that provide the means of recovery, exactly as your future sales provide you the right to recover an intangible asset, for example. You also take into account your future sales in order to see whether your assets are real assets. And it plays exactly the same role. You don't have that taking place for other entities. And I think that's where the difference lies.
Yeah, but let me answer to that, because I don't think so. Because man, each and any business, I think, has in mind to have stable development of prices. Nobody wants to have cliff effect in prices, but maybe have different costs. Because things happen, and they maybe have in one quarter, in one year, have a higher cost base than in a different quarter, but still not reacting that they immediately then increase the prices and have the same margin. And that is why business have in some year good profit, other bad profit. That is nature of a business. And therefore, I think here it is the same, because but the customer, the regulator, is making it more strict. But it is good business behavior. So it is not, I think, that kind of mechanism is totally different to a not regulated business. I really don't think so. You say, what is the real the revenue? Well, that we can debate that. Because it is okay, the intention is to have the flat price, stable price. And then if reflecting that on the revenue, but what is a real revenue? I don't know. Compared to a business which is not regulated, I think, okay, if they have the kind of damage with storm, they will also show a lower margin, but lower net profit in this quarter. But this has to be then, I think, in rate regulation, we will say we will make good for that because they can increase prices in the future. I don't see, and this is my point, I don't see it so different from other businesses.
So that you really don't see the point of this whole exercise. Which is
I have not said that. I think I see that some maybe.
I mean, it's a possible argument. But if you think, well, this mimics the normal business cycle, but perhaps a little bit more smooth, why bother? But it's a way of thinking. Jane, what do you...
Thank you. Well, if I sum it up in this way, which is, I think what I'm hearing is that from many members of the board, there's a general support for the direction that we're travelling in, and some of the way that we're articulating what we're trying to achieve needs quite a bit of refinement, but I'll find out in a minute when I ask the question at the end of paper 9A, but I think people are agreeing with what we're trying to achieve, but we'll need to find better ways of describing it. So perhaps instead of just asking you the question as it's written in the end of 9A...
Could I make a suggestion about the question you asked at the end of 9A? Nobody has really spoken about a supplementary approach, and I think that's covered in this paper.
Yes, in this okay. And also...
Because I didn't hear anybody raising concern about the supplementary.
I think we... already in previous meetings said this is the way to go.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. Separate out supplementary from the other elements if you were asking for common stuff.
Okay.
Supplementary versus integrated.
Yeah. So I guess maybe then rephrasing a little bit at the end of 9A, can I just ask if the board support the general approach that we're trying to develop
except
here?
Except that I do believe... especially for this standard, which is a bit of a deviation from what we do normally. We do need a crystal clear.
Yes.
And we don't.
Yes. Do we need to accept or are we going to...
No, I don't think so.
Nobody's screaming. I guess maybe we could just double check that people
there's
are
enough people
going forward. Going forward and the supplementary.
Do you want to speak? Do we want you to keep developing this model, or should you put down your pencil?
That's a good way of phrasing it. So maybe we vote on, do we keep going?
Yeah. All but one member in favour of keeping going.
Thank you. So moving on to paper 9B, I won't say much before we get to 9B, which is the scope paper. It builds a lot on what we've already discussed so far, but it just takes us back a stage to the discussion paper in which we describe the various features of what we call defined rate regulation, which is reproduced in paragraph 4 of paper 9B and paragraph 5. In looking at this, again, it touches on what we've already spoken about. The feedback that we got from stakeholders and looking at the analysis further is that really to develop criteria for identifying what's in scope and what's outside of scope, we really do need to focus on the rights and obligations that are contained within the regulatory agreement. And some of the features that we had used to describe defined rate regulation didn't really focus on those rights and obligations, but focused on the environment that leads to this type of rate regulation being put in force. But it did raise lots of questions around Martin's point in particular. You know, what do we mean by customers have little or no choice? Essential goods, lots of very subjective judgments that are all very useful as indicators as the type of environment where this type of regulation works and is effective, but not necessarily something that you would want as a specific criterion in order to identify whether you're in scope or out of scope. So what we're proposing in paper 9B is that we do focus the scope on having a formal regulatory framework. That framework does have a rate setting mechanism that clearly links together those rights and obligations and shows that the rate is identifying not just true ups but changes in the timing of when the entity is going to receive the compensation that it's entitled to in exchange for transferring goods and services, and those other features that we described in the discussion paper then become indicators that people can use and look at to give themselves an idea, am I likely to be within the scope or not be within the scope, but in themselves and not specific criteria. And with that, I'll just open for comments or questions.
Sue?
I just had a question on the criteria. In paragraph 16, A and C, I'm fine with and I understand. What does B actually, what sort of thing is B? What type of term are you talking about?
Right, so 16B is talking about identifying how the rate reflects the satisfaction of the entity's regulatory obligations, which is trying to get at the rate setting mechanism does need to connect how is the rate actually built up and what are the components of the rate so that we can identify is it a component of the rate that is perhaps looking at the input costs that we're going to incur.
I thought that's what A was
for. They're kind of interconnected. So B is also trying to pull out these aspects where there may be an element of the rate that is specific to some future activity that may need to take place, like a future construction or a commitment to do environmental activities, etc. So I appreciate it's not crystal clear and they do interlink with each other, but it's just trying to add a little bit more flavour to
it. If this was sort of what we were hinging everything on, it wasn't very clear to me what exactly we're doing that, but that's just words.
Okay.
Big one.
Can I ask a staff question first and then I offer my, you know, different view. If you read the paper, you know, through and you repeat some of the basic notions in the DP about no choice, impossibility, and others. But we will vote on the question. But I have a feeling, but I want to check with you. Whether the question, through question, you try to loosen your original idea.
I don't think that putting some of these features in as indicators rather than specific criteria is going to make much of a difference to which entities will be captured by the scope. But I think operationally it will make a difference because I think there is so much subjectivity around what do we mean particularly around this little choice. Whereas there's much more clarity around what the regulation actually says. But if we keep these things in as indicators, I think if somebody is subject, an entity is subject to some type of rate regulation, if it's quite clear that there is choice, there is competition, and we're likely then to be more in a market regulation type of situation, I think giving some indication of that means that when entities are trying to identify am I in scope or not, it would be a quicker process to look at the regulation and tie it into what we're trying to achieve with this model. Whereas if you see that these other features are in place, you would need to look a lot more carefully at the mechanism and the detail of the regulation.
Now, my observations by looking at this question, I see there is an intention to loosen the original idea around no choice, impossibility. Now, I
can challenge it, those angles. You know, if we define scope too narrow, you know, means we want to ensure certainty, and we will use the word like no choice and others, then the scope will be very, very narrow, and very, very few companies can use it. And several years ago, I once asked you whether the UK, there is one, you know, and but this is obvious question people will ask us. And secondly, if we want to loosen it, then we create another problem. That is, more companies may have it, they can use it. But the question is whether we can use our basis to justify the model through certainty and possibility, enforceable right and obligation. I feel, you know, if you go that way, it will be very hard. And the, this all around the debate, Martin pointed out, you know, I agree with Martin, you know, 2009 ED, so many companies say, you know, we won't use it because we have some type of, you know, regulatory, you know, decision or system. And I personally feel, you know, it is inevitable questions we have to answer, or the concern Martin raised. And as Peter mentioned about, you know, it is obvious then the right obligation. Peter, on one hand, I agree with you, you know, these kind of system or environment create the right obligation. But on the other hand, I will not agree with you. You know, I always emphasize we should be very careful. You know, the revised conceptual framework will give you the chance to justify more assets should be carbonized, because it is very easy to justify. You know, we have right obligation. You know, how about mineral rights? How about, you know, many of the intangible assets we're not allowed to recognize? If purely from the definition point of view, of course, you know, you can say, you know, they are right obligation. And this is why during the conceptual discussion, I always emphasize we should integrate definition, recognition, measurement together. Then come out a standard or principle whether we agree with each other. I think for these standards, I personally feel all are related. About 1 hour discussion we already had is actually about measurement. You know, whether, you know, under such uncertainty or certainty, we all agree we should recognize such as a liability. I personally don't feel it's because, you know, the staff paper already, you know, hint out some of aspects which will create uncertainty, chewing up, you know, bonus, you know, and punishment, and still mention about other type of uncertainty. And as a result, my observation is, at the end, the uncertainty or enforceability, there's a lot of doubt. And this is one of the major reasons in my dissent opinion in 2009. By the end, in short, my question for every board members, at the end, can we accept a company's annual profit as a liability were purely based on the decision from the regulators about new rates, or the decision about adjustment of opening account? If we feel it is okay, chewing up is okay, you can manage the account, but as regulators decide, then you can accept. I personally will not accept, you know. And companies' profitability is purely based on regulators' final decision, not only in advance, but annual, you know, adjustment.
Steve. Jen, in paper 9, you differentiate between market regulation and defined rate regulation, which I agree with, because market regulation should not reduce any assets and liabilities, and it's this timing effect that people are talking about, which I think should. I think I agree with your scope, because I think it's getting at the defined regulation, but I'm not entirely sure. I wonder whether it's tight enough to avoid situations where essentially it's market regulation that's going on. It's particularly B3, and it comes back to this imbalances in performance aspect of it. So it links in with what I was saying earlier. Energy prices have risen in the current period, and I'm forced by the regulator to keep my prices fixed in the current period. The regulator then says, okay, we know you paid more for your energy, we'll allow you to charge more in the future. That type of timing difference, I think, should be create the regulatory assets and liabilities, but I struggle to sort of think of it in terms of imbalances. Maybe it's just me re-saying what I said earlier. But the important thing, I think, is to make sure we don't capture market regulation. There may be, therefore, more direct reference to the two types of regulation, identifying the scope of each and then saying that regulatory assets and liabilities only arise in this situation might help.
Gary?
I'm bored with defined rate regulation. I personally think it's more important that feature, you say it's a feature but not necessarily determinative. I think the little or no choice, no effective competition is much more important than perhaps we're giving credit to, even if it doesn't necessarily change the determination of who's in scope or who's not in scope. But if customers had a legitimate choice, that raises the question about recoverability and impairment of future billings and future collectibles. The only reason why you're really assured or highly likely, chosen that you're going to recover these things is because you've got a locked and fixed customer base. If they had choices, they don't have to pay your bills. And again, there's many, many things heavily regulated. But this is one of the few choices where there's places where there's little or no choice but to deal with the regulation. Banks are regulated, mass transit's regulated, healthcare is regulated, but you have choices. You don't in this case. And I think that's why I think this is more important. Again, I don't think it changes who's in scope, but I think it has implications for recoverability and impairment and stuff like that.
So you would like to be part of the definition of the scope?
I think it's more important than the paper implies it is, whether it's in the scope, but I think if there's, you said it's an indicator, but an indicator, and usually there's several indicators, they break each way, but if there was wide open ability to move, I think that kills it. You'd have defined rate regulation.
Well, that means that it should be more than an indicator.
Yeah, well, I think so. And
maybe some risk of repeating myself, but what this paper brought home to me is the point you're making, I think, in here, that what we're accounting, what you're proposing we account for is the rights and obligations that come from the rate regulation. And, that's the conclusion about what is it that we are trying to capture and measure. And I think we have to keep reiterating that, but I think we have to keep reiterating it. We might also have to differentiate that from, let's say, we're accounting for the regulatory contract or compact. Because if it were the compact, then what we'd be accounting for is a single intangible asset. And we'd be thinking about more an intangible. And so I think it is, the reason I said I think I run the risk of repeating myself is that I think what we said is we're trying to define the circumstances in which unusually we're going to account for the regulation on an accrual basis. And therefore I think the circumstances means the scope criteria that you've set. I share some of Gary's concern about price inelasticity. in the sense that I'm not going to vary my quantity that much in response to changes in prices because I don't have alternatives. And yet I know when we talked about this before, it becomes really, really hard to describe when you don't have alternatives. You might not have alternatives to a bridge because there's only one bridge, but you could do a two-hour longer trip. At what point does the two-hour longer trip become not a feasible alternative? You know, so I have some hesitation about just saying, you're right, Hans, that means we have to make it a criterion, because I think we could then lose our way trying to do that. I think in describing when you cross the hurdle and you account for the rights and obligations that come just from the regulation rather than from your performance to customers, I agree with Steve's points about it's more than just market regulation, and it might be worth describing and differentiating, but it is, to me, incorrect to say we're only accounting for regulation in excess of market regulation, because I think if you decide that we're in the, you're accounting for the regulation, we're accounting for all the rights and obligations rather than trying to strip out the piece that is market regulation and saying we're not accounting for that. And so I think it's a determination of, are you in, I keep drawing a box, are you in the box that causes us to account for the rights and obligations from regulation, and if so, we're accounting for that regulation rather than the individual bits. And I'm going to go off and think more about Sue's challenge from the last discussion of the last paper, which is, do we really see additional goods and services being delivered, or is it that all we're getting is rights and obligations to adjust prices charged for the things we have delivered or we will deliver in future? So there's not actually additional rights, you know, I'm not sure which of those we're viewing. I'm not going to try and decide today, but I think we got to think about that.
I'm supportive of the scope as it is proposed here. And the reason is that all this is about, I mean, as we've discussed in the earlier discussion about being able to identify revenue adjustments. And so I think the rate-setting framework and the regulatory pricing framework provides the basis for identifying those who are entitled to this enforceable rights and obligations that form the revenue adjustment. Regarding the question whether the monopolistic aspect, the low demand risk aspect, should be a criteria in the scope, I would personally not favor that. I don't deny that the level of demand risk may have to play a role in terms of seeing whether, for example, an asset is recoverable. But I would not put it as part of the scope, mainly because I think the way it would have to be defined could create some effect, and an entity might be out of the scope, whereas one would be in, even though they would have ultimately very similar economic conditions. So it's not to say that it has not a role to play, it certainly has a role to play, but I would see it mentioned somewhere in the standard, but not in the scope.
I'm in basically the same place as Francoise. I think I'd completely agree with Gary's comments in terms of the importance of that sort of feature, but I wouldn't elevate it to being one of the criteria because I think it's cleaner and more operational as it is. But I do think it will be very important in terms of when we're comfortable to make the P&L adjustment, which is in one of your other papers, and also when we get to measurement, the sort of impairment aspects, etc. But I'd prefer to build it into those aspects rather than the scope.
Well, I must say I would like to see it included in the scope. There's no way that we would even start this project if it was taking place in a field where the customer base is not completely captured.
I think it will tend to tick these boxes anyway when that's the case. But was the feedback that on an operational perspective partly what swayed you?
I think it was that, but also I think more the emphasis on what we're trying to account for are the rights of us and obligations. And there is a kind of, there is an interplay, which is why I think it is important to keep it in there with a description and a discussion around it. And it's all a level of how much prominence do we give it? Because if you don't have a little or no choice, you're not going to find this type of regulation. If there was a lot of competition, this regulation just wouldn't exist. It wouldn't come into play because it's not necessary. So, but then, as Francoise pointed out, you get the how much competition is little or no competition. And we spent a lot of time with the consultative group, with the board previously, with the accounting advisory forum, and with other consultative groups, where this becomes a really big issue if it's a black and white in or out, and it's very difficult to find the line between the two. And it
can you give me an example where you would get into a grey zone? I mean, the
bridge.
Huh?
The bridge example. Bridge example.
Well, would bridges be in scope of this?
Well, there's a ferry example, but it's the same equivalent. If you've got a large bay that's got a very narrow mouth, you could either put a ferry or a bridge to get to one side. That's
practically,
there are some ferry companies
that want to be included bridges. In this.
Possibly, yeah. Another example is if you say that you have got. People are heating their homes with gas, for example. It's gas-based. There is an alternative. There's a competition which is you could go electric for your heating, but that is double the price. You've also got the cost of converting your home from gas supply to it. So there is a possibility of a choice, but is it a feasible choice?
We are not capable of formulating a principle that customer base has to be substantially captured.
Well, I'm not sure that we think there's going to be that much difference. Yes?
No, that's right.
So the increment, the difference in terms of the population that might be identified for the extra complexity for application, I think, is what we're trying to weigh.
And we're still going to give it prominence because it will also come into play in the measurement aspects and what we've talked about with uncertainty. And is it strong enough demand that we can actually recognize and measure these
things.
Excellent. In general, I agree with the direction of the paper, but hearing the discussion we had on paper 9A and the proposal that we have in B here, and I have a similar discomfort associated with Stephen on B3, because I think B3 will have to be revised after we fine-tune the principles as we decided in 9A, because B3 still brings this imbalance thing to the customer base, and I think if we are going to fine-tune the principle as we discussed in 9A, this will be revised as well. So I don't think we can vote in B3 as it is right now. This is the first point. And the second is that among the core indicators that we listed in paragraph 4 that comes from the DP, I think at least the item D, or the fact that it creates rights and obligations that are enforceable on the rate regulated entity, on the rate regulator, I think this aspect I would think about bringing to the scope criteria, because I think it is an important component of the model.
Where are you at? Sorry, Mara?
I was
on the paragraph 4.
Paragraph 4.
D.
It creates rights and obligations that are involved.
And that definitely we intend. That's what we're focusing on.
So as a result, in short, I think we cannot really vote on the criteria as it stands right now, because I think these will need to be aligned with the core principles as we fine-tune as a result of our discussion on AI. But this aspect, definitely, I think is important, it's key to be here.
Yeah, sorry, perhaps that was lack of clarity on my part in the paper. The intention was to focus on the 4D,
yeah,
and that's the scope, the basis for the scope criteria.
I think when you fine-tune the language, you capture this more clearly, I would say.
Yeah.
Martin?
Yeah, I have maybe a little stupid question, but do we want to make that mandatory or is it voluntary to apply this? I'm asking that question because
I had heard also from companies, and we're doing that because maybe some asking us to do it because they think it better reflects, but others don't think so.
And I have spoken also to companies which operate in many jurisdictions which have totally different kind of schemes, and they said, okay, please don't do it to us because we don't want to have this operational cost to reflect all these several regulatory schemes in our accounting, and we don't like that. We have lived now with years with not reflected in accounting, and we don't think it is significant enough for performance. We have additional disclosure, which analysts and users are happy with that, and so I think, because my mind maybe is stupid, but a little compare this with hedge accounting. That people, some people think, okay, they are in a special business doing things, and they better reflect the performance doing hedge accounting, but we don't make it mandatory. Here, I think it's a little bit the same, because my people are in this regime, and some people think, okay, it better reflects performance, others don't think. And why do we have to make it mandatory? So this was, I think, because think about it, don't have
I've got an initial reaction to that, but it's one that needs thinking through. I mean, I appreciate your point. I guess one distinction, people can choose whether to hedge or not to hedge, but they can't choose whether to be regulated or not be regulated.
No, they hedge, but can they choose to account for this?
The accounting. I mean, I think it is a good question, and it's one we'll probably come and bring back to the board.
Maybe once.
But, yeah.
Hans, could I make a couple of comments?
Mm.
First of all, I think Mary made a very important point, which is that I don't think this model is trying to account for all the rights and obligations that come out of the regulatory agreement. It's trying to focus on a subset of them, and the subset's really trying to be captured by B, particularly B3. Maybe the wording needs to be improved slightly, but it's the right to adjust the future rate for things that have already happened in the past. And I think in a way that's key to the scope question as well, because if you're just market regulation without something that's agreed, then you don't have that feature to account for, and it's a null set. It's just that feature, I think, the model's trying to account for. The second point I wanted to make was about Gary's point about whether the customer base is really captive or not. And I think one reason for not putting that into the scope criteria is that it might not have the same effect for regulatory assets as for liabilities. So it might be that if you've got a regulatory asset, the only way you can recover that is if you actually have future customers. And that might be subject to some uncertainty if they're not really captive. But it might be that if you're in the regulatory liabilities situation, that the regulator will still force you to pay the cash back to somebody, even if you don't have customers. So you might, if you exclude them because you're worried about what the recoverability of the asset, you might have an unintended consequence if it's a regulatory liability you're thinking of.
But, Ethan, if you go follow what their logic, you know, in the future there will be less customer, or originally you expect 10 tons per customer, it become not much, then you feel, you know, on the asset side, you know, it's hard. But the liability side is okay, but you know, the future customer base will also change from liability perspective. From, you know.
Yeah, and I'm not saying we shouldn't think about it. I'm just saying I think the recognition and measurement is a better place to look at it than the scope criteria and scope and definition section.
Okay. Thank you. Maybe then on that basis, if we go to the questions at the end of paper 9B and perhaps rephrase the question a little bit, similar to 9A, I and ask, are you content with us continuing to develop criteria for the scope based on the rights and obligations and the regulatory framework, and for the time being to keep these other features about little or no choice, etc., as indicators of this step?
All but one in favour. Two in favour.
I don't think
no.
Okay. No, all but two.
Thank you. Moving on then to papers 9C and 9D. 9C is looking at how we might develop criteria for recognition within the model. Much of the paper builds on what we've talked about through paper 9A specifically, looking at this as an exchange contract between the entity and the customer base. So I suggest that perhaps we split the paper into two parts, because there are two criteria that deal with that and the supplementary approach, which are contained in paragraph 3A and 3B. So 3A is looking at the extent of the performance, and I appreciate we'll still need to do some refinement of what we mean by performance there. 3B is talking about the supplementary approach. So we recognise the rights and obligations that are already captured by existing IFRSs, and then we deal with any remaining or supplementary rights and obligations through the model. The third criterion in paragraph 3C comes back to the recoverability points that we've touched on so far, and is putting a hurdle or a confidence threshold into the recognition criteria, as opposed to putting that in as a measurement issue. And the question there becomes, is it appropriate to have that confidence threshold in as a recognition point, or should we delay it until it's a measurement point? I think maybe the first two, if we deal with those, first of all, so the performance and the supplementary approach before moving on to the recoverability. I'll just mention here as well, we do have paper 9D, which contains numerical examples that are intended as illustrative examples for these first two criteria. And therefore, I don't propose to go through those examples individually, but obviously if anybody's got any questions or comments on those, please do bring them in as we discuss those two criteria.
Sue?
Jane, my comments on the sorts of adjustments that we're looking at follow from my earlier comments in terms of this notion of performance obligation, because as I said before, I agree with where you're landing in terms of the debits and credits and the picture that's provided overall in P&L, and I very much like the supplementary approach and the sort of separate nature of those two bits that you can see. I think that's useful. But where I start to get a little bit, where I have a little bit of trouble just getting my head around it in terms of the articulation is when you start to look at the description of the sort of imbalances in performance, and one of the examples that I find is not, I don't disagree with the outcome, but tricky in the articulation, is that in a situation where the customers have overpaid in this period and then there's going to be adjustment later on, I find it tricky to think about the customer having performed more than the supplier by paying too much. It's the articulation I struggle with, not what the outcome is. And I think it's linked to what the obligations are. I'm not sure, but, and I don't have an answer, but just an observation.
I guess when I'm looking at the performance of the customer, I'm thinking of it in a general term, in that, yeah, if I bought some goods from somebody, what is my performance obligation as a customer? And the only thing that I can see that I have to do is actually pay up. And if I've paid more than I'm obliged to pay,
you actually haven't.
This is where I'm switching between the individual customer and the customer base. So as an individual customer, I've paid exactly what I've agreed to pay. But if I then pop myself out into the customer base, as a customer base, I've actually paid more than I'm obliged to pay, because I was told the price is an estimate, it's going to get adjusted later on. So I'm sitting here as my wider customer base thinking, I have performed by paying,
but I've now overperformed because I've paid more than I was obliged to pay. And okay, I'm not going to get cash back, but I'm now going to get services again in the future for which I don't need to pay again because I've already paid. So I don't know if that takes you any further, but it's a different way of articulating.
Very abstract. This is where you really lose me. I mean, I know what you're trying to say, but that's why I get very wary of making a distinction of customers and customer pays. It's basically the regulator says you're overcharged and you're going to pay less in the, you're going to charge less in the future. Customer pays doesn't even think about this, they just pay. And
I think, Hans, this is why some people don't favour the supplementary approach, because they look at the whole thing from the customer base point of view and look at it purely from that aspect, and I can see an attraction to that, but we, I don't think, can step away from
it. It's all between the regulator and the company, the entity. Customer base is just passive.
The customer is just the pricing mechanism established, the unit rate sets.
Nothing. The customer base has nothing to do with the regulatory.
It does with performance. Yeah, think about performance obligations more in the other directions.
Yeah, I think maybe it's the terminology of performance. Yeah.
I'm not saying I won't get there. I'm just saying that's where I'm. I have to recalibrate all the time.
In revenue recognition, when a customer pays a bill, you say that it performs.
I think we do. Yes. Yeah.
Mary.
I think I'll start with this. You know, maybe we should rethink the performance, the characterization of payments as performance, and maybe that would allow us to step away from the customer base, you know, bring into discussion, because if I think partial performance, making it non-executory, is an analysis that one would apply in a context in which you say the accounting for the regulation is executory contract. And if we are, you know, and I think I'm looking at it through my lens, if we are saying that we're trying to define the circumstances in which we account for the rights and obligations, and I would say it's all the rights and obligations that come from regulation, we aren't dependent on trying to pick out a piece of performance that shifts us from executory contract, you know, that means there's been disproportionate performance on something that we're counting for as an executory contract. We just are in the, okay, we've decided that if you have these characteristics, you're in the accounting for the rights and obligations of the regulation. What are those rights and obligations at this point in time, and let's account for them? And it's the individual rights and obligations, not the license or the contract, it's the individual rights and obligations. So we may not need this whole notion of the customer base has overperformed. I think we can, you know, and so some of the expressions, and I think this is me trying to answer Sue's concern about it's not the outcome, it's the rationalization, and it feels like a rationalization rather than an analysis. So I think we're just pulling from, feels a bit like we're pulling some familiar thoughts that we use elsewhere, rather than saying, okay, if it is the rights and obligations we're accounting for, how do we identify when they arise? So that was one comment. A question I have that I think is not answered in this paper, I don't want to try and answer it on the spur, but I'd like to ask the staff to think about for a future paper is, and it kind of goes back to the criteria, is it is regulation that puts some degree of demand risk on the regulated entity, should it be within the scope, should it be qualifying? So, for example, if I don't get trued up for unders and overs on the volume of how many units I sold, but I do get trued up for costs I may incur or extra activities that I have to perform. And I just want to think through if it means that I have some substantial demand risk, should that take me out of the type of regulation that we're accounting for? And that may be a different way of getting back to that near monopolistic, characterization. And maybe we'll decide it's in measurement. Maybe we won't. But let's just think about that, because bearing demand risk or not bearing demand risk was a focal point of IFRIC 12 in terms of thinking about who's in which, you know, which situation. So I think we have to address that. And the third is, I really, really don't want to be asked to make a decision about 3C today about incorporating the IFRS 15 variable consideration model. And the reason I hesitate is that's a specific answer that we crafted in the revenue standard. It may prove to be a useful tool, but I think we first have to decide how we deal with variability, and that's kind of my demand risk question, but it's kind of some other things. So I'd rather not have to decide it's forever out or forever in today, because I think it's premature. I had some difficulty answering the question about 3A, because I think we have to go back to Sue's question from the beginning of, are we saying that there are additional separate performance obligations that I satisfy, or is it that the right and obligation that I'm accounting for is adjustments of P, either for past deliveries or future deliveries of Q? And I think A assumes that there are separate, sorry, 3A, to the extent to which the performance of the entity exceeds or doesn't exceed. I think if you think that you have separate performance obligations, then I think you might answer it one way, as opposed to the rights and obligations it gives me are adjustments of the P, then I might answer it differently. So I kind of feel like we have to answer Sue's question before we can address 3A.
I'll help you with your
Yeah. Thank you. Actually, yeah, relating to the Mary's questions, is there any separate performance? And may I ask a question about example 4 in the 9D? It talks about separate performance, because the performance entity made was repairing the damage of beach and recreation, and because of that, regulator paid 200,000. And then eventually, in your example, this company recognized profit. The question is, maybe presentation issue, would it be revenue, or revenue is collected when you get the payment from the customer? Because the customer will pay over 3 years, 4 years time by 50,000 each. So then, will the revenue be achieved across the 4 years, or the performance itself was done in the first year? So therefore, as in terms of profit, you are saying that this company can recognize all the profit in the first year, and the second year, third year is just a collection of the money. However, it was not clear in the example whether they recognize revenue top-heavy basis, or they recognize revenue over 4 years. So I think this is exactly the point, whether you think the performance towards the regulator is a part of the revenue, or revenue is only from customer basis. So what is current inclination from the staff?
Rather than give an inclination, I think I just want to agree that the question you've got, I think, really is a presentational question, and it's a tension that arises with this supplementary approach. In that particular example, I think if we were in IFRS 15 world, looking at the local government in this case as a totally independent customer coming along and saying, will you do this repair job on my beach for me, then the 200 would be revenue, because it's a single customer, we're the supplier, we do that repair work, and the local government say, thank you very much, we'll pay you that money, and it's revenue all in one go. Yeah. In this case, we then have this added complication that it's not the local government that's going to pay for it, that responsibility gets passed on to the customer base, and eventually it does go through revenue, and it's a timing point of view. So the way that example 4 is set up, if we do the supplementary approach and follow through with the same presentation approach, you're right, in year 1 the revenue would be the 50,000 that has been billed through the customers, and the other 150,000 is just our regulatory adjustment through profit or loss. And then each of the next 3 years will be roughly 50,000 in each year going through the revenue line. But again, presentation is something that we need to come back and discuss as to, again, I think it ties in with exactly what do we mean by performance and what are we trying to represent with the information.
I think, you know, this discussion show we now run into a dilemma. So we already agree we should, you know, go ahead, start from the revenue-based results, and then as a supplementary. Then we go step by step. We will feel more and more. It seems, you know, not so obviously, or maybe in some cases it's okay, in some other cases it's not okay. You know, this is a typical example. You know, I agree with Saul and Hans' worry. You know, purely describe the deferred debit credit as performed, underperformed and overperformed. I don't think it is a good way. Is because if you look at transaction, you know, the idea to apply, you know, the current standard is you already perform. You know, double entry also, you know, you perform based on the contract, you already paid or paid advance, and from the entity's point of view, you already provide service or goods. You know, I feel hard to then say that, you know, okay, you performed, but you know, part of the payment you get will be described as not performed or overperformed. I feel very hard. This is why from the beginning, I feel you anchor on the revenue standards may not be, you know, appropriate way, basis for us to develop a model. And I want to emphasize, the key is very simple. You know, how to justify the deferred asset and liability. And I personally view some transactions it's easier to justify from revenue standards, but other transactions it is very hard.
So going to paragraph 3 in the conclusions, I agree with A and B, subject to A perhaps being worded better to capture the sort of things we've been talking about. But I very much disagree with C. It seems to me that I'd be happy to say that it's highly probable that the regulation has created an asset or liability, but this concept of a significant reversal I don't think is going to work. Imagine doing fixed asset accounting on the basis that it is highly probable. You only capitalize an asset when it's highly probable it will never be impaired. We won't have many assets recognized, or recognize a derivative if it's highly probable its value isn't going to fall, or we'll never recognize any derivative. So I think that is shouldn't be a recognition issue. And when it comes to measurement, maybe some pressure to not recognize an asset unless it's highly probable that we're going to collect the whole of that asset. But even there, I'm probably not going to support that, because I feel that in order to provide useful information, if we start constraining this, we're going to destroy the P&L at the end of the day.
Steve, without a certain
limit, or destroy the supplement to the P&L.
Well, destroy the supplement to the P&L is going to be dismissed as meaningless.
Yeah.
Because it'll be half an adjustment, and it'd be better to have no adjustment or the whole thing rather than half an adjustment.
Although in the staff's defence, I think they set out was the hope that the opposite was going to be achieved, right? That if there was more confidence around the legitimacy of those adjustments, because they would actually be realised,
yeah,
you saw that as being potentially helpful, right? But I think Steve disagrees, but they were trying to make it more useful.
Yeah, I mean, we did take into account some of the feedback from the IFRS 15, because obviously we've been trying to piggyback on the IFRS 15 concepts, and there was information in the basis for conclusions on 15 talking about
analysts and investors not finding it helpful in the context of variable consideration, albeit where if there was revenue being recognised that then didn't actually appear, so it was intended as a constraint. But I can appreciate certainly from the discussions we've had today, perhaps we don't lean quite so heavily on IFRS 15 as we perhaps
have. On the other hand, variable consideration you have not yet delivered, you have not yet performed. In this case, you have already performed.
No, not always. They have. Yeah. Yeah. Variable consideration, they have.
I don't know exactly the price.
Francois?
Well, I had a few comments about this highly probable criterion. I was not surprised to find it here exactly for the reasons that Jane said. I mean, we're here trying to provide a better depiction of revenue for these entities. So you could expect that users would have the same expectations regarding the revenue line as has been expressed when IFRS 15 was developed. And so probably it's in the course of the project that we should investigate more precisely whether this need would be confirmed. I had, however, a difficulty in having this fully symmetric. I would appreciate if we could get more, if what I'm going to say is indeed sustaining practice, because that's the way I understand it happens, but it may not be relevant in all circumstances. What I understand of these price reviews, regular price reviews that take place, is that so you have what you have in the scope, the price setting mechanism, so you know how things are going to be discussed with the regulator. Most of it, you could tell about the outcome, but then there are certain elements, parameters, just eventually because you have had a certain number of costs that are not so usual to incur that will be taken into account. You don't know exactly to what extent it's going to be. Well, anyway, what I understand from those reviews is that the negotiation is about the plus. But as long as the price setting mechanism size is robust on how much the entity will then invoice beyond the pricing mechanism, there is almost no negotiation. So in other words, the liability side of things is rather certain, whereas when there is uncertainty, it would be more on the asset side. And so if you apply a very high hurdle for the liability side, you end up with a risk of overstating your revenue. And I would not be in favor of that. Now, I'm sensitive to your argument, Steve, of saying, well, users need something neutral. But I'm not necessarily convinced that the way the reality develops is neutral. I don't believe that it is symmetric in reality.
I think if asymmetry becomes a key feature of the model, then we better stop it now. Because I don't think the industry is ever going to support an asymmetric rate regulatory model.
It's worth investigating.
I think there's some investigation. I mean, there is already, I think, in the industry checks and balances. And I think naturally, I think Francoise is right, there is more pushback against assets rather than liabilities. I don't think it should be an automatic asymmetry. I think we do need to, and I'm not going to ask the questions at the end of paper 9C, because I think we do need to go away and come back with some deeper analysis, linking in with everything we talked about this afternoon. But I think there is already in the industry a kind of built-in, I think, hesitancy to book some of these regulatory assets, particularly when, and I appreciate it's not come through in the paper, if we're at a time where we haven't gone through the rate determination yet, the discussion with the regulator to get the final rate approval, sometimes the mechanism works that we can automatically put through a rate adjustment. So if we're going to have a full-blown review every 3 years, there may be an automatic adjustment on an annual basis. And there is a reluctance, I think, to put some of these automatic uplifts in the rate through, because if the entity does get it wrong, there's potentially penalties to be incurred if they then overcharge the customers. So I think there are some natural checks and balances for this, but I do think you're right, we need to come back with a bit more detailed consideration of the symmetry or the asymmetry aspect.
Could I just comment on the symmetry point? Because I think the wording that's here doesn't actually achieve symmetry anyway. I think it's false symmetry. Symmetry in wording, but it's not actually symmetry in outcomes,
yeah.
I think. Thank you.
Yeah, Steve suggested that there's an issue on example 4. Therefore, providing some repairing service on the area. I'm wondering whether this transaction is under the scope of this model. We just talked about the scope of this model in paper 9B. So this transaction is under the scope we just discussed.
Interesting question, because it's not for the delivery of...
Right. So this is just a general service anybody can do. So what I'm saying is that the scope of what we discussed before, IMB, investigate what the consequences, whether what kind of the companies might be included in or not. That's another one thing. Another thing is that there are highly probable uncertainties. So can you say this is a kind of a, actually it's a measurement of certainty. However, can you say this as a kind of a existence of certainty? Like in a IFRS 15 pair of lines. Peter.
Well, I think it depends what's generating the uncertainty about the reversal. If it's that that it's certain how much you can charge, but you don't know how many customers there will be, then I think that's uncertainty about the outcome. If it's uncertainty about whether the regulator will even accept it, then I think that's more like that's the distance uncertainty.
Big war, and then
no, very short, you know. I personally feel it purely from the logic the staff laid on, the certainty seems for me it's necessary. It's because, you know, certainly try to capture those enforceable rights, or the result of enforceable rights. Otherwise, you know, if there are some additional asset liability, but the probability was so low, and the people will say, wait a minute, you know, particularly for me, so, you know, I don't agree, because you want to recognize something with such a high uncertainty. So I think, yeah, I'm right. The reason why you absurd is to link to the impossibility, all right?
Yeah, recoverability and enforceability, yeah. But I think, like you say, the message I've got...
If you delete it, then how we can ensure those, you know, certain, you know, enforceable right obligation will be captured.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, like I say, I don't think I'll ask the question at the end of 9C, because the message that I've got is that we need to do something more on the articulation of the criteria.